We'll turn on the internet and call this meeting of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission to order. It is March 24th at approximately 9:30 in the morning, and we're here at the State Capitol Building. I'm Dusty Johnson, and with me today are fellow commissioners Steve Colbeck and Gary Hansen. Our first item on the agenda today is an update from Ms. Gregg on Consumer Reports.
The Commission has received a total of 110 contacts since the last report was prepared for the March 10, 2009 Commission meeting. 44 of the contacts involved telecommunication service, 11 contacts involved electric service, 5 contacts involved natural gas service, 4 contacts involved natural gas and electric service, 10 contacts involved cell phone service, 29 contacts related to the Do Not Call registry, and 7 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 590 of the 658 complaints received in 2009 have been resolved, and 2,510 of the 2,513 complaints received in 2008 have been resolved.
Great. Thanks, Ms. Gregg. Any questions? Hearing none, we'll proceed to consumer complaints. It'd be my intention to take up items 1 through 6 at the same time, unless anyone has a concern with that. Hearing none, then we'll open up CT07-001 through CT08, CT07-005, so, as well as CT08-001. We'll look first to Ms. Moore as reduced rates filed a motion to dismiss. Ms. Moore?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Meredith Moore appearing on behalf of Reduced Rate Long Distance Company this morning. We did, in fact, file a motion to dismiss the 6 complaint dockets, which you just referenced. These motions were filed after settlements had been reached with each of the individual complainants identified in each of those dockets. It took longer than we had desired in order to effectuate resolution of those matters, but checks were received, were distributed to each of the individual complainants, and I believe now have all been cashed. Therefore, under those circumstances, we believe that it is appropriate to close the dockets. I had sent each of the complainants a copy of the motion to dismiss and have not heard any objection from any one of those complainants at this particular time about dismissing these documents. So, therefore, on behalf of Reduced Rates, I would respectfully request that the Commission dismiss each of the dockets referenced today. Thank you.
Thanks, Ms. Moore. At this time, we'll look toward, we'll just ask to see if any of the complainants are either present here in Pierre or on the phone lines. Hearing none, we'll look toward staff. Ms. Gregg, Ms. Semler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Kara Semler for staff. I've been in touch with the complainants, and they're all satisfied with the resolution and none object to the dismissal today.
Any questions for any of the parties? Yes, Commissioner Colbeck.
Yes, mine would be for Ms. Moore. You said that all the checks have been cashed and everything is taken care of, but does your client understand what they did in the first place? Have they taken any steps to make sure this doesn't happen again?
Yes, Commissioner. I would represent to the Commission that my client does understand what has happened here, understands the nature of the complaints. They are no longer doing any marketing in South Dakota in order to ensure that this does not happen. They are also, or have taken, I should say, in the past, they have taken more diligent steps towards ensuring that the third-party verification process is met and that they keep more detailed files for their own records so as to ensure that if there are any consumer questions or complaints that are raised, they have the documentation to better discuss those issues with the consumers first themselves before it becomes elevated to this type of a matter. I think it's also safe to say that since the initial show cause docket was opened in this matter, and that's a different matter than what's currently before the Commission today, but it's what gave rise to the Commission's investigation of my client as well as these individual dockets, that no further complaints have been filed with the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission, and my client would certainly intend to keep it that way.
All right. Thank you.
Other questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
I will move that in CTO 7-001, CTO 7-002, CTO 7-003, CTO 7-004, CTO 7-005, and CT. I'm jumping ahead, I think.
No, I think that's right.
That is correct. CTO 8-001. That the commission shall dismiss the complaint and close the each of these dockets.
Motion has been made. No second is required. Is there any discussion on the motion? I would just note this is the sort of resolution we want, and I know this takes a lot of time on the part of reduced rates as well as on staff, and certainly the complainants as well have time invested. And so thanks to everyone for reaching getting a resolution that it seems as though everyone's satisfied with. Other comments? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. So thanks to everyone. It would be my intention to hold electric item number 1, the filing by MidAmerican, as I think that may take a little more time, and I don't know that the rest of our agenda is particularly heavy. Anyone have any concerns with that? Hearing none, then we'll proceed to hydrocarbon pipeline item number 1, which is in the matter of the filing by TransCanada, Keystone LP, for a siting permit for the Keystone XL project. Question for the commission today, though, specifically is, shall the commission assess a filing fee not to exceed $660,700 with an initial deposit of $8,000? And secondly, shall the commission authorize the executive director to hire consultants and enter into contracts with those consultants? At this time, we will look towards staff for their comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Kara Semler for staff. Staff proposes to assess the statutorily assigned fee and the $8,000, as I understand, and as Mr. Kennecke could maybe expand, has already been deposited. I believe we already have that. He maybe has it with him now, the golden envelope. So I don't anticipate there'll be any objection from the applicant on that. And we have sent out requests for proposals to hire a environmental, a socioeconomic, and an engineering consulting firms to help us with the evaluation of this docket, and we'll just ask that those could be handled through the executive director.
Thanks very much. We'll see if the applicant has any comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, commissioners and staff. Brett Kennecke from PIER for TransCanada Keystone Pipeline. We did file an application, and we look forward very much to working through that process with not only the commissioners and staff, but the citizens of South Dakota. I'm in possession of a check for $8,000 made out to the PUC in anticipation of your impending order. I'll drop that off on my way out of the building. And we have no position on staff's request to hire experts. That's certainly business between the commissioners and the staff and not ours. So we look forward to having public meetings later on this spring and going forward from there. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Questions? Maybe we'll just pause prior to that and see if any other person has wants to make any comment on this. Hearing none, any questions? Yes, Commissioner.
Yes, Mr. Kennecke, there was a bill that actually went through the legislature this year and has to do with clarifying this language in the statute that we're talking about. I just want to make sure that TransCanada interprets the law as we do, that the it will be not to exceed $667,000, but the way we figured that is that you're under the impression that that's the correct way to figure out the amount because the law will change on January 1 in the middle of this proceeding.
Thank you for the question, Commissioner. Did you figure the amount then based on the new law or the old law?
Well, the amount should be the same, and I just want to make sure that TransCanada understands that the amounts will not vary between now and then.
Thank you for stating that. I've always viewed that question and then the ultimate bill and resolution as a matter between commission counsel and staff, essentially. I don't know that any utility companies took a position on that bill. I think the bill clarified to a substantial degree any question that was there, and we do understand how the process works, and we don't have any problem with it. Thank you for the question.
All right, thanks.
Other questions? Yeah, go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could someone, I was not able to check the last and foremost hydrocarbon pipeline that we just completed. Can someone help me with the amount that was the total cost that was assessed for Keystone?
I could check with,
your memory, I'm
with
sure.
Ms. Forney. I'm sure she would have those numbers, and I could get back to you with that.
That's fine. I can ask her, too. I'm just curious what that amount was and thought if I was curious about it, perhaps at least one other person in the
go ahead, John.
I don't know the exact amount, but it was in this order of magnitude. At my recollection, it was like $690,000, something like that.
I just
from memory, but...
I had asked Ms. Forney yesterday, and I think she indicated it was somewhere around $650,000, but she didn't specifically check, but just like you had mentioned, Mr. Smith, that was sort of the general ballpark.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, I was curious whether or not that was the expenses were actually reached, that $650,000. It was?
They were, Mr. Commissioner. I think we incurred expenses over and above actually what we could assess last time.
Any idea how much? Okay.
Much over? I don't know. I just don't have access to those.
Mr. Chairman seems to know everything, so I'll ask you.
Well, I think I do. It's been categorically proved that I don't. I think that's where the $690,000 that John mentioned was. I think we were a little bit over, but it wasn't hundreds of thousands.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks. Although I do think... I mean, your question really leads me to another, which is, this filing fee is based on the estimated cost of the project, and Keystone XL, if constructed, would have significantly more length, I think, I'm recollecting, than the first Keystone pipeline did. Is there a reason, then, that the two assessed filing fees are so close? I mean, if it's 30% more mileage, and I'm making that number up, shouldn't the cost have been somewhere in that neighborhood more, or the filing fee have been that much more?
I would not be able to, Commissioner, speak very intelligently to that. I don't recall that the total assessed costs on the previous construction were in the range that's been quoted here this morning. I'd have to go back and take a look at that.
Excuse me. This is Bob Canale. We just pulled it up off the Internet.
Right. I was over.
$351,000.
The fee was 361. Wait a minute. Where is it? Oh, 368. That's the actual.
351,100, according to the order we just pulled up.
And the reason why those numbers are so different is the cost of this pipe. You know, this is a lot longer pipeline, and so the project cost is a lot higher. The estimated project cost.
More categorical proof for Commissioner Hansen and others that not only do I, but Mr. Smith also our memory shouldn't be allowed to prove anything. So thanks, Mr. Canale.
It was also based on the same formula that we used last time, so the cost was just less, the estimated cost for that portion of the pipe.
So the estimated cost of this pipeline, at least with regard to its footprint in South Dakota, would be not quite but almost twice, which would be a function of two things, perhaps increasing commodity costs or other increasing costs, as well as an increase in mileage. Mr. Kennecke?
This pipeline is almost 50% longer through South Dakota. It's also a larger diameter, which is it's much more material being used for the larger diameter of the pipeline.
Okay, thanks. Turning perhaps to the question with regard to the consultants, Ms. Semler, I don't have any problem providing the authority to the executive director to make that decision. I wonder, if this decision is made at the time when we have parties other than the applicant or even including the applicant, I wonder if it wouldn't make sense to have staff indicate to intervened parties, who staff intends to select, and then if they've got a problem, they would have 5 days or something to alert the commissioners. I don't know. I mean, I don't know why a problem like that would arise. I just wonder if we should pause and give them that opportunity.
We certainly could. Extensive research goes into our even just selection of the three we've asked to provide bids, and I question that the interveners have the time or the desire to do so, but they certainly may, and providing opportunity for comment is never a bad thing.
Well, and I just think given the likely price tag of this consulting, you know, if we're not going to have the commissioner select the consultants in an open meeting, then we should at least give those people who have legal standing to raise an issue with us if they want to. Other comments or questions? And again, I don't think we need to slow down the very short time frame.
The only other challenge I could see is that intervention time frame is 60 days. And then at that point, we'll have to have an open meeting to allow those interventions. It could push back the time frame that we can get someone hired.
It wouldn't be my intention to wait until all interventions are received and acted upon. I mean, if you would decide tomorrow, the executive director, then only the applicant would need to be informed.
Sure, that makes sense.
Other questions or comments? With that, perhaps we can take up action on the first question.
I'll motion in HB 09-001 that the commission assess a filing fee not to exceed $660,700 with an initial deposit of $8,000.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With regard to the second issue, I would move the commission authorize the executive director to hire consultants and enter into contracts with those consultants after having given all those granted parties status 5 business days notice prior to doing so. Motion has been made. Is there discussion on the motion?
We'll speak about that for just a minute here.
Sure.
You're thinking that in this process when people want to intervene, if they had intervened and have something to say about the consultant that's hired, you're just basically wanting them to have a voice in the decision. Is that correct?
To the extent that they would object. I mean, for instance, this is the applicant's money. I mean, they're the ones ultimately paying the bill. If they were to see that the executive director wanted to select consultant X as opposed to consultant Y, they may want to raise issues with regard to the cost. And that seems highly unlikely, but it's at least possible. Also, to the extent that consultants are working with staff to try to determine the public interest with that statute, individuals who have party status may want to provide feedback as to the background of the consultant. I mean, I agree with Ms. Semler. This is highly unlikely given the technical nature and background of these consultants, but I feel like we should at least give people an opportunity to raise an issue with us if they want to.
And those letters or those concerns would actually be addressed to the executive director, correct? And made part of a public record?
My thought would be that they could indicate their concern to that they could file some sort of a letter with the executive director. It'd be entered into the docket. The commissioners would then be alerted to their concern. And I suppose the commissioners at that time could request that the executive director pause, not enter into a contract until we had more of an opportunity to hear concerns. Again, we wouldn't have to do that, but it would at least be an option.
Okay.
I mean, once the contract is signed, sealed, and delivered,
sure,
all discretion on, or I would think, a great deal of discretion on behalf of the commissioners is lost.
Sure. All right. That's it. Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Hearing none, we will proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks. That will proceed to pipeline safety item number one. This deals with a filing by MDU for approval of a waiver, although today's question is actually whether or not to amend the commission's order. Commission staff filed that request, and we'll look at this time to Mr. Solem and Ms. Semler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Kara Semler for staff. The commission entered an order approving a partial waiver regarding this particular request on November 12th of 08. PHMSA, upon the commission's review and entering of an order, PHMSA has 60 days to review and to comment. That deadline was missed. PHMSA did miss the deadline. However, submitted a letter with some concern and recommendations. And although it's not binding, staff recommends that we adopt said recommendations.
Anyone from MDU wish to comment? Anyone else wish to comment? Hearing none, under any commissioner or advisor questions? Go ahead, Commissioner.
I just want to make sure that I'm reading this right. This is actually stepping up the rules, correct?
Correct. It adds some training requirements, and it would put those into the commission's order.
Okay.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I'm sorry. I'll motion in RM0. I'm sorry, in PS07-001, that the commission grant the motion to amend the commission's order.
Discussion on the motion. I would have a question for Ms. Semler. There's a very minor change in the wording that was suggested in the letter by PHMSA and what you have in your motion. Is there anything? I don't know that it appears to be a substantive change, but I just thought I'd ask.
I did not intend to alter any way PHMSA's recommendation.
Well, and it's very minor. Jeffrey Weiss requests that the education be for, quote, technicians who perform functions covered by the waiver. Your wording is that for technicians responsible for functions of its requested waiver. I don't know that it matters, but I thought maybe the deviation meant something.
It means nothing. Might
gotcha.
As well use PHMSA's language.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Commissioner Colbeck, do you have any concerns? I don't know that it's necessary. I think they both say the exact same thing, but.
No, I don't have any concerns over that.
Okay.
As long as, I guess, commission staff is fine with the legalities of it.
The only difference is adding back in the words performing. That's it. It was just for some reason left out of staff, so my guess is it was just an inadvertency. But
no, I don't think Mr. Smith, I mean, Ms. Semler's wording is responsible for, which I think is equivalent to performing the.
It probably is. I mean, I think that's the only difference, though, between the two, isn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't just the omission of a word. It was sort of a different verb, and I think they mean the same thing. And we're probably fine with the motion as made.
I agree. I just think it just gets down to which one you think reads better.
Well, Commissioner Colbeck, which version you want on your motion?
We'll go with the staff's version.
Okay. The motion is to amend the commission order as suggested by staff. Any further discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks.
I probably jumped the gun on that motion. Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. All right. With that, let's proceed to rulemaking item number one. This is RM09-001. This deals with rules on pipeline safety. And how shall the commission proceed? I know Ms. Semler, Mr. Solem, and Ms. Splitsoe sure have done some work on this, so we'll turn it over to them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kara Semler for staff. After staff drafted its proposed rules to open up a rulemaking docket, we communicated with pipeline operators and gave them all a chance to comment. And we had some great feedback, had significant comment. Staff incorporated some and chose not to incorporate other comments. We think it's most appropriate, therefore, for the commission to have a chance to review all such comments before it decides on its rulemaking form of rules. So we propose that the commission allow a 30-day time frame for pipeline operators to comment, much like we did in the interconnection rules that we've recently been investigating. Staff then have an opportunity to reply to explain to the commission why we did what we did, and from there you all can decide in what form you want the rules to look when you open a rulemaking.
Does any operator or other person want to make any comment at this time? If that, any questions from commissioners or advisors? I have just a couple. On page 7 of your filing, on staff's filing, and this deals with the inspector reporting requirements, it is noted in staff's comments that the report will not be filed with the commission. I am presuming, though, that the pipeline safety manager and staff generally would have a copy of that.
Correct, yep. Our pipeline safety inspectors have a complicated form of record keeping that they will be tracking all of that. Mm-hmm. But because at that point we don't believe it's a contested case, it's not something that requires commission decision. At some point, if the pipeline operator objects to the inspector's recommended resolution, then of course it will come to the commission for decision making.
So the fact that the report will not be filed with the commission shouldn't lead me to believe that it won't be held by the commission.
Correct.
Okay. And then on page 9, again in staff's comments, and I'm looking on the third paragraph, it talks about the inspector has the discretion to waive the 30-day reply timeline. I mean, is that unilateral discretion?
Yes. However, if a pipeline operator, again, objects, the commission is always the ultimate decision maker and could resolve any conflict. But oftentimes these sorts of things just may take longer than 30 days to get resolved because of the technical nature.
Okay, thanks. Other questions? Yes.
You mentioned just right away on page 5, or I'm sorry, on page 1, that staff cannot efficiently complete its inspections without a more formal dialogue and process. Do you anticipate this to save time, or is this just more of a clarification to the rules?
Right now there are no rules that dictate the process of pipeline inspections, so I think this will save time, and in fact PHMSA is really pushing South Dakota to draft some rules, something that would help guide the process.
Okay. So we can, this will make our process more efficient.
Yes, and I believe it will make it more transparent. There will be more items docketed. The commission will see more, and hence the public will see more.
All right. Thank you.
Did staff review other states' rules in this area prior to drafting?
We did, and much of the language we used was from other states, and we used states' language that, you know, our PHMSA rep did recommend we look at.
Thanks. Other questions? Without any comments or action, I mean, I would just highlight that, you know, you talk about openness and transparency, so you engaged in a dialogue with the operators prior to this, so that was sort of one round of feedback. Then we'll enter into this sort of docketed filing, and then there'll be a round for anybody to provide comment and tweaks. And then we'll enter the official rulemaking procedure where there'll be an official comment period, even more official than this commission one. And so that will be three rounds prior to the point where if the commission approves them, they go to the rules review committee with the legislature, where there would also be an opportunity to comment and perhaps tweak. So four opportunities for people to make their voices heard, and I think this product is a pretty gosh darn good starting point. So thanks. Other comments? Any action? I would move that the commission open up or rather provide these rules, offer these up for comment. Is that the proper motion you're looking for, Ms. Semler?
Yes, I think both Mr. Solomon and I would appreciate some time frames included in the order, just so because we like to use these going into all the upcoming inspections, so
sure.
We could keep the process moving along.
Well, if memory serves, your memo did allude to some sort of Staff now, here we go, respectfully request that the commission open a rulemaking docket and allow a 30-day formal comment period for operators and a 10-day staff reply opportunity prior to the scheduling of a hearing mid-summer 2009. And I would certainly add that 30-day and 10-day timeline into the motion. Comments on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks. Well, under the telecommunications portion of the docket, item number one is TC08-127, and this deals with the ongoing matter of Quest attempting to modify the reporting requirements for establishing a PIU. And the question for the commission today is, shall it approve the request for an additional 60-day extension of the suspension? And then secondly, how shall the commission proceed? Verizon filed a motion to extend, and at this time we'll look to Verizon for their comments.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. This is Tom Dixon on behalf of Verizon Business, and I'm responsible for the filing of the motion to extend the suspension. I will not go through the details of the motion extensively, but I think what's important is to note that the parties have been doing discovery in other states where this similar matter is pending, most particularly in Utah. And we have agreed to import, to use that term, discovery from Utah into other states because the processes are the same in each state for trying to identify unidentified traffic as Quest has proposed in its tariff. We had we have exchanged discovery, and that was completed on March 16th. And during that discovery, it was apparent that Quest is not identifying international traffic that originates outside the North American numbering plan area. And by that, I am stating that Quest is identifying international traffic that arises anywhere other than that area, which would include Europe, Asia, Africa, and treating that traffic as unidentified, even though it's international. Obviously, international traffic is not intrastate traffic, and by definition, if Quest is not properly identifying international traffic that arises outside of the North American numbering plan area, then that traffic is being rated or has the potential for being rated intrastate, and if so, it is charged higher rates. Quest and Verizon are going to meet on Friday the 27th, we're trying to address this issue to quantify the amount of traffic that the Verizon business has that meets this criteria, that is, international traffic that originates somewhere other than the North American area. MCI and Verizon business have long been a heavy travel provider of international traffic across the world, and we're obviously a worldwide provider. Because of this factual issue, there continues to be discovery, but also we have further settlement conferences going on. It appears rather evident now, given the fact that we've identified one clear issue with the tariff, and that is relating to the identification of international traffic, that there are factual issues in dispute that we are working on to resolve. I should point out that when MCI / Verizon Business provides its percentage of interstate use to Quest, it uses Signaling System 7 indicators that are available to Quest as well. And by looking at those indicators, it is possible for MCI to determine whether the traffic is international or not. And that would include not only North American international traffic, such as from Canada or from Mexico, but also traffic for the rest of the world. And because of that, we can set a PIU and advise the Quest of that fact. Accordingly, we are requesting that the Commission extend the suspension period for an additional 60 days. It's my hope we will reach an agreement on how to address this issue now that it's clearly been identified, and if so, that we would not proceed to hearing. But because there's only 60 days remaining, I'm also requesting that the Commission at least direct the staff and the parties to establish a procedural schedule that would at least serve as a backstop to make sure this matter proceeds expeditiously and is completed with an appropriate period of time and still allow the Commission time to rule on such a hearing. And I'm available for any questions if I can answer any.
Thank you, Mr. Dixon. Does Quest have any comment?
This is Colleen Siebel with Quest Corporation. Mr. Thompson was unavailable today, but we do not have any comments at all on the request.
Thanks, Ms. Siebel. Staff, any comments for Ms. Kramer, Mr. Thurber, Ms. Libri-Baker?
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. Staff would recommend granting the motion to extend the suspension and then their further request to order the parties to develop a procedural schedule, and I'll work with Ms. Forney on getting a hearing date and getting that to the parties and work from there. And then AT&T has stated that they do not object to the motion to extend.
And thanks for the reminder, Ms. Kramer, that there were interveners. We should pause and see if LECA and SDTA or others have any comments at this time. No, we better. Rich, we better get you.
There we go. Sorry about that. Richard Coit on behalf of SDTA, and I guess today I could also speak for LECA. We're just really in a position of monitoring the docket at this point. We have no objection to the further extension. Sorry.
Thanks very much. Questions?
I just have one. Ms. Kramer, could you walk me through the timeline? If we do grant the 60-day extension and how that affects why we couldn't, when we go to hearing, the clock is already ticking, correct?
Correct. By extending it another 60 days, that will expire May 31, and that's when the new rate would go in unless the parties agree that it would not, because that's the maximum amount of days at that point that it has been suspended.
Okay. So if we don't give them the 30 days, we'd have to have a hearing and determine the rate before May 31st. Is that correct? Or am I'm confused?
I think either way, we need to get a hearing in by the end of May and allow time for a decision. Unless Quest were to agree to not put the rate in when they're legally entitled to. I think it's a total of 180 days that it can be suspended. And as of May 31, that will be the 180th day, give or take a day or two.
All right, thanks.
You're welcome.
Other questions? Any action?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move that in docket TC08-127, that the Commission grant the motion to suspend the docket for an additional 60 days, and that the Commission direct the parties to develop a procedural schedule by April 1st.
Motion has been made. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Telecom item number 2 is in the matter of the filing of an interconnection agreement between Quest and DSLNet Communications. Shall the Commission approve the interconnection agreement? Anyone from Quest or DSLNet Communications wish to make comment? Hearing none, we'll look to staff.
The agreement was properly filed and executed. It does not appear to contain discriminatory language. No comments were filed. Staff recommends approval.
Any questions? Hearing none, I'll move that the Commission approve the interconnection agreement. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Telecom item number 3 is TC09-007. This deals with intelligent solutions for a COA to provide inter-exchange telecom services, and that's the question for the Commission today. Shall it grant that COA? Anyone from Intelligent Solutions wish to make comment? Hearing none, we'll look to Mr. Binder or Ms. Kramer.
Thank you. Intelligent did file on February 24th for a certificate authority to provide internet exchange, telecommunications, and local exchange services in South Dakota. They intend to offer these services in existing Quest territories throughout the state. Staff does recommend granting certificate authority to Intelligent Solutions Incorporated with restrictions on prepaid, with the exception that they do not offer prepaid services or offer deposits, and also with rural safeguards.
Okay, thanks. Questions?
What was the last thing, the safeguard? What was that?
That the COA be contingent upon rural safeguards for local exchange service.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Comments or action?
I'll motion in TC09-007 that the commission grant the certificate of authority to Intelligent Solutions according to staff's recommendations.
Motion has been made. No discussion. No second is required. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Telecom item number 4 is TC09-008. This deals with Norlight and their application for a COA to provide inter-exchange telecommunication services in South Dakota. We do have Mr. Geralds on the phone. Go ahead and proceed. Any comments?
No comments.
Great, thanks. Staff, any comments?
Thank you. Again, Norlight filed for certificate of authority to provide inter-exchange and local exchange on February 25th. They'll be offering these throughout the existing Quest territories. Commission staff does recommend granting certificate authority to Intelligent, provided that they do not offer or require prepaid deposits or accept prepaid services, and that they're also subject to rural safeguards.
And to grant Norlight the COA with the same conditions.
Yes, Norlight.
Perfect.
Thank you.
Any questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
I will move, Mr. Chairman, in TC09-008 that the Commission grant the COA to Norlight Incorporated under the conditions as recommended by staff.
Motion has been made. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. With that, we'll proceed back to our electric item, which is EL07-015. This deals with filing made by MidAmerican for approval of its proposed energy efficiency plan, and that's what the commission is dealing with today. At this time, MidAmerican has, or rather earlier, MidAmerican submitted a revised plan, and we'll allow the applicant to make comments. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. This is Rick Lighthouser, Manager of Energy Efficiency from MidAmerican Energy. First, I'd like to thank South Dakota Public Utilities Commission for the opportunity to work with the Commission staff, especially Mr. Brian Rounds and Mr. David Jacobson, regarding development of MidAmerican Energy Company's proposed 2009-2011 Energy Efficiency Plan. Based on the meetings we've had and many conference calls, if the Commission decides in favor of approving MidAmerican's proposed Energy Efficiency Plan, we will look forward to working with the State of South Dakota, South Dakota Public Utilities Commission, and the Commission staff and our mutual customers to deliver these programs in a manner benefiting the state and our customers for many years to come. MidAmerican's objectives regarding its proposed energy efficiency plan include the following: increasing customer satisfaction by helping customers manage their energy use and energy costs, and helping them implement a comprehensive set of tried and true energy efficiency programs, assisting our business customers by increasing their competitiveness and productivity, and by improving the environment. MidAmerican will meet these objectives of the energy efficiency plan in the following ways. First, by focusing the proposed programs on the customer. MidAmerican's programs have been designed to make it easy for customers to participate, and that's critical for the success of the programs. Second, by investing in infrastructure necessary to support successful implementation of the programs. MidAmerican attracts customers to the programs by offering financial incentives. However, successful energy efficiency programs require investments in program infrastructure. Advertising is needed to increase customer awareness, trade ally management to help local dealers, architects, engineers, and other professionals who sell services and benefits of energy efficiency. By monitoring and evaluating program performance and administrative systems to ensure that efficient program operation is accomplished. By investing in these additional systems, MidAmerican helps ensure that customers enjoy their participation in these proposed programs. And finally, we will accomplish these objectives by remaining flexible during the implementation of the programs. While MidAmerican has designed the program requirements to meet the needs of most customers, we also understand that some customers need special services. Our program managers will work with individual customers to ensure that their energy efficiency needs are met. This time I'd like to give an overview of the proposed programs in MidAmerican's portfolio. We have four residential programs, including the residential equipment program, which will be offered to both natural gas and electric customers. The residential energy audit program, which is one of the most successful programs that MidAmerican has ever offered. It goes under the marketing name of HomeCheck, and that too will be offered to both natural gas and electric customers. The residential load management program, which goes under the marketing name of SummerSaver, which is direct load control of central air conditioner compressor. As such, that will only be offered to electric customers of MidAmerican Energy. And then, of course, last but not least, we will offer a low-income weatherization program, and we'll work with the Department of Social Services to help implement this for both natural gas and electric customers. And at this point, I'd like to apologize. We inadvertently, in the filing, referred to the Department of Human Services and understand that we'll be working with the Department of Social Services to implement the low-income weatherization program. On the non-residential side, we will be offering the non-residential equipment program, which involves rebates for a variety of energy-using equipment. And again, this will be offered to both natural gas and electric customers served by MidAmerican. In cases where the non-residential equipment program, which is sometimes referred to as a prescriptive program, when there are situations where a customer identifies a need, an energy efficiency need or project that doesn't readily fit into the non-residential equipment program, we will offer the non-residential custom program, which allows for special projects that can be handled on a case-by-case basis. And this program also will be offered to both natural gas and electric customers. And finally, on the non-residential side, we will offer the Small Commercial Energy Audit Program, which goes under the marketing name of Business Check, comparable to Home Check on the res side. This isn't targeted towards small and mid-sized commercial customers, typically those customers with facilities or buildings of 25,000 square feet or less. And this one, too, will be offered to both natural gas and electric customers. As such, the programs that we have proposed here include a core set of programs, which we believe is crucial. These are crucial core programs that make up a sound basis for an energy efficiency portfolio. As I said, most of the programs will be offered as joint electric and natural gas programs. MidAmerican will only provide rebates for measures that save energy sold by MidAmerican. When appropriate, MidAmerican will seek to work with other South Dakota utilities to share costs and program resources to make it as easy as possible for South Dakota customers to participate in multi-fuel programs. MidAmerican has designed a comprehensive program portfolio to meet the varied needs of different customers, and these include both natural gas and electric customers, residential, commercial, and industrial customers, homeowners, commercial building owners and tenants, customers in existing and new buildings, customers purchasing new equipment, and customers with existing and working equipment, and also customers making substantial capital investments, such as in new furnaces, and customers making smaller purchases, such as those purchasing programmable thermostats. In summary, MidAmerican proposes to file an annual report to the PUC each year that details program results for the previous calendar year and lays out key challenges to be implemented in the current year, including where appropriate changes to participation and budgets. Once again, on behalf of MidAmerican, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to work with the state of South Dakota, the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission, and the commission staff to develop and offer these programs. Mid-American looks forward to working with you and the staff to successfully implement these programs to the benefit of the state, our customers, and Mid-American Energy Company. And at this time, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have about Mid-American's proposed program.
Thanks, Mr. Lighthouser. And we'll hold questions until after we've heard from staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Brian Rounds for staff. We've been working with Mid-American on this filing for a long time, and they've been great to work with and very amenable to all the changes that we suggested. Most of the changes that we suggested were cuts to programs that staff considered to be high in free ridership. We also suggested cutting some programs that were high administrative costs because of low anticipated subscribership. And last but definitely not least, probably the biggest change is we asked Mid-American to propose a performance incentive that was identical to the one that the commission had already approved for Otter Tail, and to use that incentive rather than trying to recover lost margins. With respect to the program as currently proposed, there's just two small points that I want to make. The first is in regard to the low-income weatherization plan. I was going to point out the Department of Human Services versus Department of Social Services mistake that was in the application. And I know that, you know, that's not because they don't know. I know that they've been in contact with the weatherization program manager at the Department of Social Services. But there's also another issue with that program in that with the recent stimulus package, that weatherization program could be sort of flooded with cash, and that they're going to go through some growing pains and may actually have a difficult time spending all the money because they're going to have to do so much training and ramping up new staff and things like that. And this is a program that staff actually suggested they do in the first place. Because small increments in rates that will be added with this energy efficiency surcharge, I think affect low-income customers the most, and so we want to make sure they get a piece of the action. With the changes to the weatherization program, I've talked to the manager of the weatherization program, and he said that the inclusion of Mid-Americans, their extra cash into their program basically would still be effective. And even though they're going to have growing pains for the next 2 years, that money's not going to be there forever. And so they definitely still want to use that in their program. That being said, though, we would just prefer to allow Mid-American the freedom to kind of dynamically adjust their budget and work with the manager of the weatherization program to make sure that, you know, if they can find more cost-effective ways to save energy, they should be doing that elsewhere in their budget, as long as the budget stays at the same level. Second point I want to make would be with the true-up filings. In their revised proposal, they suggest making two filings, one in January to readjust their budget as needed, and then another in April to basically figure out what their performance incentive should be for the previous year. We suggest doing one annual filing, and that to coincide with whenever they have the metrics needed to decide their performance incentive. That way, it's kind of justification for whatever budget changes they might make as well. And it would also be, I think, more efficient use of staff time. So with that, I would just recommend approval of Mid-American's revised energy efficiency plan, along with the tariff sheets as attached to staff's memo, and the suggestion that Mid-American make just one true-up filing annually rather than two. And we'll be available for questions.
Questions?
back to your what you were just recommending, I guess how soon can we adjust this? Only yearly, is that correct? I have no intention that it would go south, but if this program was to go south, would we have to wait a full year before we can adjust rates?
The way that it's written basically is that they would come in to adjust rates if needed every year. They'll definitely come in for the performance incentive approval too. So, I mean, I'm not sure how you mean if things go south.
Well, if costs, and that maybe this is for Otter Tail too, but if costs start to increment and cost more than the benefits, say we're looking at, I'm just making up a number, all of a sudden it's costing us $30 a year for an electric customer to have this, and instead of $1.49 for every dollar we're investing, we're only getting maybe 50 cents out of every dollar we invest. How quickly can we correct that?
Well, we're looking at this as an approval of a budget, so that can't actually happen.
Okay.
Without your approval, they can't spend more. They can't spend $30 per customer per bill without your approval the prior year.
Oh, okay. If you bear with me, I'll just go through my notes here. I guess it would be in the cost recovery and performance incentive in that. It says non-lighting electric customers. What exactly is a non-lighting? Is that someone without a yard light or without a parking lot? Is that correct?
I think that's referring to city customers like with street lights, things like that. I'll let Mid-American take a stab at it, though.
I guess maybe I can define my what makes you a lighting customer? Do you have to have so many poles, so many lights?
This is Debbie Katsunis from Mid-American Energy Company. I can address that. We do not currently have any programs that would affect the lighting customers, and therefore we are not proposing to recover any costs on a lighting bill per se.
Okay, and I guess my question is, what makes a lighting customer a lighting customer? Who doesn't qualify for this? Would you have to have so many pole lights?
A customer that has a light and is billed for a light on their bill would only be charged the energy efficiency cost recovery factor on the non-lighting cost. So for a customer that did have a yard light, the rest of his bill would receive the factor. The light itself would not receive the factor.
Okay, so yard light is actually billed separately.
That's correct.
Okay, that makes more sense to me then. On the incentive, on the performance incentive, who had set that target? Is that set by Mid-American, or was that set by staff, that 30% of the incentive?
That was set by Mid-American, but is done based on the precedent set by Otter Tail that you guys approved last year.
So we're fairly confident it's not a gimme. We know that this target is set at a attainable rate, but not an easily attainable rate?
We think so. It's a pilot, so we'll find out next year. But that's definitely, I mean, we're pretty confident, especially since we also asked for that in Otter Tail's case, too.
Okay. On the residential low-income program for gas and electric, I know that electric, in 3 years, they anticipate one person, if I'm reading that correctly. And then on the gas side, they anticipate 16 people. And the third year, they plan to spend $46,000, which is $2,875 per person. How would that – is that the stimulus money? Hopefully we'll offset that, because that seems like a lot of money to spend on $46,000 on 16 people.
Well, that's the way the weatherization program works. Basically, they have agents that go out, do audits on low-income customers, residents, and they basically come up with suggestions for improvements, and then they go carry out those improvements. And typically, they're spending around $2,500, I believe, per house. And I think with the stimulus money, that's going to be raised up above $6,000 per house.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's actually pretty typical. And one of the reasons we like this program is because they can tap into the administration that's actually being used by that's being provided by the Department of Social Services. So they don't have to administer the program as much as they do the rest of their program.
Oh, sure. On the also on the residential low income, are we doing rentals? And if I own a rental, do I receive that benefit, or does it actually have to be the person paying the bill or the renter that would receive the benefits? In other words, if I own low-income housing and I rent it to someone, do I get that benefit? Or is this specifically for people that have a lower income? Did I make my question? I kind of bumbled there.
Yeah, I think the low-income program works for renters, too. I'm not sure, though.
Okay. I'm just wondering where the benefits would go. Would they actually go the street to the person with the low income, or would they maybe go to a landlord who has low-income housing?
They definitely go to the owner because they're going to be improvements to the home itself.
Okay.
But, you know, the person who's going to see the benefits is going to be the person paying the electric bill or the natural gas bill.
Yeah, and that's kind of the reason I asked that question is, if we're going to make things more energy efficient, is it going to be the rentor or the rentee? And I would imagine that if they got the benefit of this, we want them to be putting the money in, but they're not going to be very motivated to put it in their landlord's house.
Well, and the nice thing is it's not cash. It's just improvements to the home. So it's the rentor wouldn't be getting cash payments and then using it for something else. It's definitely improvements that are done by the person doing the audit.
Okay. So we're hoping that the person that owns the property is the one who's going to be making the improvements, even if they're not paying the electric bill or the gas bill.
You mean even if the rentee is?
Yeah, I'm renting a house from you. I'm paying the electric bill. Is it beneficial for me under this program to put in CFLs or to put in gas-saving incentives?
It's definitely beneficial to whoever's paying the bill.
Okay.
Especially if it's the actual low-income customer paying the bill, because those improvements should be going directly to reducing that bill.
Okay.
This is Rick Lighthouser from MidAmerican Energy. If I could inject a comment, typically the way we have seen low-income weatherization programs operate in most states is that the programs are targeted at single-family home-owned residences. So the money is going to owned, customer-owned housing. If for some reason the Department of Social Services wants to look at somehow extending this to rental property, we would be happy to work with them to try and come up with a process to make that succeed.
Okay. Thank you for that. One more question on the staff's memorandum. It says, assuming commission approval, MidAmerican plans to begin offering initial programs and recovering costs on May 1st, 2009. Do you have an idea what those costs from right now until May 1st would be?
This is Rick Lighthouser again. If I can turn back to the introduction,
okay.
We have some tables in there that include a breakdown of the budget. And if you bear with me a second, I'll get to the page.
I'm sorry, table 2 in the introduction.
Yes, it's on. Sorry, I'm having trouble turning pages today. It's on page A110, table 3, actually. this shows the budget's broken down by account category.
Okay.
Planning, design, administrative, advertising, promotional, incentive, those kinds of things. Typically, the cost that you would see between now and May 1st would be in the areas of planning, administration, advertising, and promotion as we're preparing to ramp up the programs for implementation. The incentives, monitoring, and evaluation. There may be some equipment costs that occur between now and May 1st. But the incentive dollars and the monitoring evaluation would come after the programs are actually implemented. And again, to further clarify those first categories, planning and design, administration, advertising, or promotion, not all of those dollars, of course, will be spent between now and May 1st. Only a small portion, whatever is necessary to get the programs ready for implementation.
Okay. That's all for me, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have just a few. First, I'd like to say hi to Diane Munns, if she's on the line. She was instrumental as president of NAROC in establishing a national goal from the regulators for efficiency and energy-related issues. And I don't know if she's aware of it, but our commissioner, Dusty Johnson, has been spearheading efforts in South Dakota in that arena, and appreciate both of their leaderships. I have some questions for Mr. Lighthouser, and first I'd like to say that I'm impressed with the comprehensiveness of this instrument and all of the information that's been provided to us. Can you tell us how this compares with other load-serving entities in the industry? It's been a while since we've gone over one of these, and this seems to be a bit more comprehensive and inclusive than some of them that I've seen.
Do you mean in terms of the program portfolio and how it compares to others in the industry?
Exactly.
I think it's very comparable. As I mentioned during my prepared remarks, the core programs that are being focused on include the residential and small commercial energy audits and the residential and non-residential equipment rebates. I think those are a basic four programs that if a load-serving entity in any state passes up on offering any of those four basic programs, I guess from my experience, having worked in energy efficiency for 17, 18 years, it really can't be defined as a basic comprehensive portfolio of programs. And then in addition to that, offering programs such as low income and customized are also pretty standard. The customized program simply recognizes that no matter how hard you try to develop a program to meet every need, we have thousands, tens and tens of thousands of customers, each with their own particular interests, their own particular energy needs. And to me, it's inconceivable that the non-residential equipment program can address all of that. There are going to be occasional situations where a customer has a project or an energy efficiency measure that is beyond the norm. And so the custom program is offered to recognize that. The residential load management program, while I think that's pretty standard across the industry, the only difference between the program that we are offering and what you might find elsewhere is primarily due to the size of our electric service area. We have a very, very small electric service area in the southeast corner of the state, and as such, I think that's going to create a natural upper limit on the participation. If you look at residential load management programs across the country, it's not unusual to find tens of thousands of customers that participate in such programs, but we just don't have that large electric service area. I hope that answers the question.
It does. Thank you very much. In regards to the comprehensiveness of the programs, on your residential load management program, I noted that it does not include geothermal heat pumps. What is the reason for that?
Geothermal heat pumps have an entirely different load shape. Typically, geothermal heat pumps are running almost continuously in order to maintain even temperatures throughout the residence. That's a distinctly different load shape than you would find from a typical natural gas furnace, electric air conditioner load profile. And so it's more appropriate for a direct load control program to address the typical gas furnace, electric air conditioner, central air conditioner setup. It just doesn't lend itself to a geothermal system.
Thank you. Commissioner Colbeck had asked a question regarding the residential low-income program and the number of participants and the cost in relationship. Under the non-residential customer program, I assume you're going to give me the same answer, but the information shows that participation is estimated to be one electric customer in each of the last 2 years, and 4, 6, and 7 natural gas customers for those 3 years. The costs are $48,000, $58,000, and $57,000 for each of the 3 years. That's combined electric and natural gas costs. It seems like a lot of dollars, as Mr. Colbeck pointed out with the, Commissioner Colbeck pointed out with the residential low income program. Could you explain? It just seems that there's a lot of money being spent for. Is the benefit there?
Yes, it is. As Mr. Rounds mentioned earlier in his comments, the $47,000, for example, in year three works out to about $2,800 per customer. That is only a portion of what is typically spent in most jurisdictions on participants, qualifying participants in low-income programs. In jurisdictions that Mid-American serves other than South Dakota, typically the amount of funds spent per home is upwards of $6,000 or $7,000 per home. The weatherization work that's done in low-income homes is far different, far more extensive than is typically done for non-low-income weatherization work. For example, when insulation is installed in a low-income home, it's typically installed in a manner that's referred to as dense packing. Community action agencies have special equipment that allows them to, and I apologize for the use of the word that I'm going to use, cram more insulation in between floor joists and roof joists in order to tighten that home up as much as possible. Typically, a community action agency will go through a low-income home. Every single room, every single aspect of that home in order to reduce the monthly energy cost to an absolute minimum. And that's why the higher cost.
Thank you. Thank you. I think cram is a good word. I think it explains to us well what you're explaining.
I'm getting from around this table here, I'm getting a lot of grimaces. I apologize. That's probably not a very technical term to have used.
Well, we understand. I have just a couple other questions I think I can actually skip. I did notice that under your performance incentives that if customer response program to the programs exceeds expectations, you may adjust your marketing and other parameters in order to keep spending within the budget. That may answer some of the concerns previously expressed, but I may have been reading while staff explained, and perhaps it's my fault as commissioner. Why was the originally filed plan rejected? How was that something that we did?
Basically, staff just had a lot of objections to some of the programs and the cost recovery incentive mechanism, I guess. We didn't want to allow for the recovery of lost margins. And then there were also a couple of programs that were undersubscribed, and there were a couple of programs that we thought were high in free ridership. And we're also waiting to see what would happen with Otter Tail Docket. So that was kind of the reason for the original delay and revisions.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Staff recommends a single annual filing. Wanted to check with MidAmerican as far as your feelings with that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Debbie Casunas. MidAmerican's willing to agree with that, and we can change to a single reconciliation per year.
Okay. On A123, it's noted that if the overall budget and the filing mentions, and Mr. Rounds reiterated that there would be an opportunity to move dollars sort of between program types, but if in mid-year the budget was exhausted, the Mid-American could come and request some additional authority from the commission. Just a question for Mr. Rounds. Did staff give any consideration to some sort of a band? So, you know, I don't know, I'll make a number up, 10%. If the programs are working and if they're cost-effective, should commission approval be required up to a certain point?
I guess, you know, the advice I gave Mid-American was that they should consider your approval of this program to be an approval of the budget. If they want to recover any additional costs, they should have a very good explanation for spending those dollars, and if that's going to be exorbitant, they should come in and ask for that budget increase. We had the same thing, and this is mostly based off our experience with Otter Tail again. Right away before they even initiated their plan, there was so much buzz about their program that they realized it was a lot of their programs were going to be oversubscribed. So they came in and asked, and they said, is this budget solid or can we spend more? And our advice was don't spend more unless you come and ask to spend more first.
Of course, they can spend more, and just will be on the shareholders' backs as opposed to ratepayers.
Right. You know, spend more if you think you can get it approved, basically. So, you know, we didn't actually say, you know, within a band of so much percent. We just said, you know, at your own discretion.
Well, I did find persuasive, you know, MidAmerican's comments about, you know, not wanting to stop a program mid-year, that can send bad signals to trade allies and consumers. Mr. Rounds, any idea on how long it would take to get regulatory approval from this commission or denial from this commission mid-year?
That's a good question. I think if I think if the justification was well laid out, we could do it pretty quickly, probably within a month or maybe 2 months.
Well, and maybe rather than, you know, make any formal motion or try to put some sort of a band in, I mean, I would just provide that direction from at least one commissioner to staff that, I mean, I know everybody's always busy and everything's always urgent, but to me, it's sort of a one-month delay. I think MidAmerican could foresee that and could sort of project out far enough that, hey, in 45 days or in 60 days, we might be in trouble. And so a 30-day regulatory lag doesn't seem onerous. Anything beyond that, I think, could have a negative impact maybe on program offerings. But MidAmerican, any comment on kind of where I'm going?
This is Rick Lighthouser. I think that sounds appropriate. What we have provided from in those pages you were referring to gives us some implementation tools that we can use to manage participation and hopefully give ourselves some time to anticipate when we might hit a situation like this.
Okay. So I would just add that, Mr. Rounds, for whatever it's worth.
The idea of a band around the budget does have a considerable appeal.
Well, and that was initially which way I was leading. I mean, at this point, my inclination would be to, you know, let's try this, you know, for a year or two. If we determine that there's just too much regulatory lag, you know, mid-year and requesting additional authority, or if that's not workable for MidAmerican, then we can always look at sort of a band approach. But let's give it a shot. B15, dealing with residential equipment. Table 3 does a good job laying out market barriers and strategies to deal with those barriers. You know, here and in other places, it talks about educating consumers. And I just thought MidAmerican could give us a rough idea. I mean, is this, you know, bill stuffers and a few PSAs, or is this sort of a traditional education, or does it go beyond that?
Well, I think that it includes a variety of things. It includes education for both trade allies and customers, where we have opportunities to get together in a group setting. We frequently make presentations to customer groups, civic groups, senior groups, school-related groups regarding the programs and try to stay focused on the core programs, the energy audits and the equipment rebate programs. Providing education to the trade allies. They have extensive networks of contacts in their own businesses, and these programs are very much in their interest in order to promote these programs. And so we've seen in other jurisdictions where trade allies become very effective partners in helping to educate not only their fellow trade allies but also customers. Over time, this could evolve to other kinds of things. So that's where, in my opening remarks, I emphasized the flexibility that we would bring to implementation of the programs.
Moving to the residential audit, B21, you describe a home check online. You know, Mr. Lighthouser, I find myself rather skeptical about the value of online tools, auditing tools. I mean, there are so many of them out there already. Now, granted, they don't import 12 months of data. But can you make me feel, does this have more value than I presume it does?
I think the value is in for those customers who are on the fence, so to speak, as to whether or not they want to have an on-site audit, whether or not they actually want to have an auditor come in, do a walkthrough assessment, do direct installs, free measures, those kinds of things. On the surface, you might say, well, it's a free on-site audit, but Our experience shows that there are a significant number of customers that would they like to take advantage of an on-site audit as sort of a precursor to their commitment to an on-site audit. And that's what we have seen. We've also used it, this kind of ties back to our earlier comments about whether or not a program might be oversubscribed. This is one tool that we have used in the past, promoting the online audits during periods where there has been exceptional demand for the on-site audit. This specifically happened to us during late 2005 when Hurricane Katrina hit, and the media just ran with energy stories practically every day for 2 or 3 months, and we saw the demand for online on-site audits spike significantly, and we really had to work to keep our audit capacity up in order to meet the demand.
Go ahead.
At one point, we decided that we were getting so far scheduled out that we switched our promotional efforts and directed customers initially to the online audit, and it worked very effectively.
Well, I can understand why demand for an online audit would go up. I have a hard time imagining a tremendous value coming from that. I mean, you know, take the Hurricane Katrina instance. So, you know, thousands of people in South Dakota across all different service territories scramble to go find an online audit somewhere, whether from their load-serving entity or elsewhere. I mean, do we have anything to suggest that that is translated very reliably into action beyond the audit, beyond the online audit?
That's a good question. To date, we have not gone back and sampled those customers to determine the extent to which they have implemented recommendations. That's a very good question. If I could just put the Hurricane Katrina example aside for a moment. I think one of the benefits of the online audit that MidAmerican has is it helps the customer benchmark where their energy costs are to other customers in their area. It tells them whether or not they're average, above the average, or below the average. And certainly if they're above the average, there will be some recommendations there for things that they can some low-cost, no-cost kinds of things that they can do. But your earlier question is a good one. I guess the only comment is that we didn't think of sampling the customers and going back to see follow-up action.
So can you give me an idea of, you know, in the budget, I mean, is this online audit? I mean, it's a tool that already exists. So is it contributing a great deal of costs to the budget? I mean, to be very frank, even if I think it's of an exceptionally limited value, it doesn't matter very much if it also has exceptionally limited costs.
I'm just consulting here with one. If you could give us a couple of minutes, one of my staff members could go check the percent of cost the online audit contributes to the total program cost, if you would like us to do that.
Yeah, that'd be fine. And again, I mean, I'm willing to provide a lot of deference. I mean, this is a pilot program to a certain extent. You know, MidAmerican, you've been doing this in other jurisdictions for, you know, at least in Iowa, I think you know it, in 17 years. On a pilot project, I'm willing to provide some deference, you know, and presume that you've got a pretty good feel for what works and what doesn't. But I'll just raise that as sort of an ongoing concern I've got. If you have more data by the end of the call, great, but it's not going to hold up, you know, my interest in approving today. So.
Okay. Well, something we can do is is take a sample of South Dakota customers who have participated in the online audit and cross-reference that to, we can't do that. We haven't started the program. We could do it in other jurisdictions just to the cost, one of my colleagues here, the cost for the online audit is $463 per month. So it's a very small part of the overall program budget. I hope that helps.
So if that's, $6,000 a year we're talking about, compared to in 2011, or 2010, a $350,000 residential audit, bucket of costs. Yeah, I mean, it certainly is small. So, great. 1/70th or something in that area. All right. We've had some complaints recently from consumers that have indicated that on-site audits they've gotten, and this doesn't have anything to do with Mid-American, but that on-site audits they have received have been very poor compared to those they received when they lived in a different town and they had one 5 years ago. So this just makes me wonder about the quality of the inspectors and the folks that are doing these audits. Can you give me an idea? I mean, are we doing any follow-up with consumers to see whether or not they had a good experience, whether or not they thought it was a value? Are you doing any quality control check on the folks you're contracting with to do this service? Walk me through that.
We don't do a formal quantitative ongoing evaluation. Periodically, we do a process evaluation. We hire an independent third-party consultant to come in, and they do a sample survey of customers who participate in the program. And although I don't have the most recent report in front of me, we received extremely high marks. I believe the combination of those customers who were extremely satisfied and those who were satisfied was above 90%.
Oh, great. Thanks. You note, and again, still talking on the residential audit, a copay for a programmable thermostat. What about, was there any discussion about some sort of small copay for this on-site audit? I think most people realize that, $15 would be a heck of a bargain or some number, but do you get more consumer buy-in when they have to pay something? Any thoughts from Mr. Rounds or Mr. Lighthouse or anybody else?
I think there are wide differences of opinion about a copay on this kind of an on-site audit. I think way back in the beginning we might have considered it, but we distinguished this kind of an on-site audit from audits that might be done more on the non-residential side. Involve engineering firms. The expenses on the non-residential side for audits are much more expensive, and in those cases, we do expect 50% upfront participation from customers in order to, as a gauge of their commitment to going forward with energy efficiency improvements. On the residential side, I don't think a copay would necessarily have a beneficial effect. In fact, it would probably have a more negative effect, and it just, in the end, it could raise our administrative costs to maintain participation.
Well, and Mr. Smith just made a comment in my ear about I shouldn't presume that there's not significant customer commitment just because they're not ponying up dough. Mr. Smith, do you want to share sort of the nature of the commitment?
Well, I'll just say that I just went through, this wasn't an audit, but just having had Mid-Continent and having had a deal with them on upgrading my phone and the rest of my stuff. I mean, there's a real there's a pain in the neck commitment that a person has to make in order to become involved in something like this. So I would tend to think in order to have somebody come into your house and mess around, and there's some level of commitment there anyway, I would assume.
Well, your point's well taken. Thanks, Mr. Smith. Okay, a question for staff. The CFLs and the waterbed mattress pads were pulled out of here, presumably at staff's request. Walk me through specifically. I know you spoke with Commissioner Hansen about generally why you pulled or requested that certain characteristics be pulled. Talk to me about these.
I guess these are just instances of free ridership concerns we had. We think those are improvements that consumers are probably making on their own right now. And I think in one of those, the water, not the CFL program, but the other one, waterbed mattress pad, I believe that there might have been some high administrative costs, and that mixed with free ridership, we just didn't like the program. So this is a discussion we had quite a bit on Otter Tail side with the CFLs. I think, you know, most homeowners are putting in their own CFLs at this point, and I don't know why we should have utility bills paying for that.
Well, and I do understand, and of course, Otter Tail had a little bit different approach if memory serves. I mean, these CFLs weren't being put in during an audit. Their CFL was sort of a broader program, I think, of some rebates and some, you know, giving them away at places if memory serves. I don't mind this CFL approach quite as much as I did Otter Tail's more robust one. You kind of get rid of the free rider problem if you charge something. I mean, even a dollar to a bulb, a copay. I mean, sometimes people know it's the right thing to do, but they have a hard time actually getting out to the store, grabbing them, and putting them in. I wonder if there isn't some value in as the guy or the gal is doing the audit, having a few bulbs in their truck and say, well, if you want to buy them, I got them for $2 a shot. I mean, that may raise administrative costs. I don't know. I would just pause to let MidAmerican and staff make a comment about that approach.
This is Rick Lighthouser again. I have to think about that one. In other jurisdictions, when we do the home check residential energy audit, we will provide up to six compact fluorescent bulbs in areas where we know there will be a minimum usage of them. I think this is kind of comes down to more of a philosophical issue.
Well, Commissioner Johnson here again. I mean, I do understand staff's argument that these bulbs are gaining market share. Are we really getting much change in consumer behavior by giving away bulbs? I mean, I sort of understand the free rider argument. You take that one away if you're charging them a dollar or two for a bulb, or at least you mitigate the argument somewhat. Again, I don't want to do anything that's going to, you know, add administrative costs or be cumbersome for an auditor, but Mr. Rounds, any thoughts?
I wouldn't say you take away the free ridership just by charging them half price or something. I purchase all CFLs for my own house, and if somebody offered me a half price deal, I'd definitely take it, especially if, you know, the government wants to pay for it or utility customers want to pay for it. I think that does mitigate some of the free ridership. We were just of the opinion that especially this being a pilot program, we wanted to start small, and those are some of the cuts we made. And if you feel differently, that's fine with us if you want to allow for those programs.
Chairman, I would just offer something else. You just mentioned that that the utility personnel drive around and have CFLs in their trucks to hand out to customers when they're there, you also run into a big potential problem when they do something like that, and that's they're now starting to directly compete with retailers and contractors. Whenever we've run into that years ago when utility personnel kind of off the cuff start offering non-regulated services in competition with retailers and contractors, and you can get a very significant recoil reaction from those people when that happens. So just to clarify that.
Well, no, I think you're right, and it wouldn't be my intention to have every, you know, Mid-American, you know, truck have CFLs in it, but, you know, presumably if we were going to get that pushback, we'd also get it, you know, perhaps to a lesser extent with the copay on the programmable thermostat or on, you know, giving away as part of these audits some of these other energy, you know, relatively low-cost energy efficiency items. It just seems when it is as part of a home energy audit, a lot of those arguments are muted a bit. Rick, you'd said that you wanted some time to think about it. Any new thoughts on your end?
No, not at this time. If between the staff and the commission itself, if at some future date you want to investigate this, potentially we could pick a more isolated area of our electric service area. If such an area exists, it is kind of compact down there in the southeast corner, but just test it or something. That's the only thing that I could think of at the moment.
Well, I know we raise a lot of concerns about free riders. I mean, but to a certain point, if reducing the energy usage has some value to the system, it has value to the system. You know, I mean, if the cost-benefit analysis is positive, if we're paying for it, if the ratepayers, rather, are paying for it, then that's still a value. I mean, the fact that it might have been done 2 months later on the consumer's dime, we don't want to worry too much about that. I mean, certainly I think it's a reasonable factor to think about, but... Well, we can come back to that in a little bit. B31, and this deals with the residential load management program. For Mid-American, I mean, are water heaters never really a part of this program?
Some of Mid-American's predecessor companies have tried that before, and... This was just particular to our predecessor companies. It didn't turn out to be as effective as we have seen with the central air conditioners, and we actually discontinued that program. I know that in some other parts of the country, once in a while I hear about programs to control water heaters, but not with great frequency.
Okay. As far as retention in the program, can you give me an idea in Iowa and other jurisdictions how long are people coming in and out of this program with frequency?
It depends on your definition of frequency. The programs are... for example, the residential and non-residential equipment programs are based on a replacement philosophy as opposed to a retrofit philosophy. So when equipment fails, that's where we key on the customer decision. They could obviously go with standard efficient equipment versus high efficient equipment, and we go after them to make the right decision. Then it depends on timing of other kinds of equipment decisions. Oftentimes, gas furnaces, electric air conditioners.
So, Rick, specifically with the residential load management program, can you give me an idea? I mean, if you get 100 people at the end of year one in the program, at the beginning of the next heating season, what sort of retention number would you expect?
I apologize. My colleagues were just raising the binder, and I was wandering off talking about equipment. I guess that means I haven't had enough caffeine. The retention rate that we've experienced, for example, in Iowa, we have in excess somewhere around 55,000, 60,000 participants in the residential load management program, and we're 400 a year dropout. If you heard that, we lose around 400 customers a year.
Wow. Okay. That is significantly lower than I thought. I mean, I was just asking because, I mean, to some people, $30 a year probably seems like a lot, but I didn't know. I mean, obviously it is. I mean, the 60,000 people minus 400, it's obviously sufficient, and the program's not that much of a hassle. Okay? Okay, can you, I'm looking on B35, table two with the market barriers. You know, one barrier is a negative opinion of program expressed by heating and cooling dealers to customers. Tell me more about that.
Occasionally, we will get calls from customers who, for whatever reason, their air conditioner during an event where we are cycling the compressor, their air conditioner will stop operating, and then from the customer's perspective, sometimes there's a little bit of confusion. If they learn that at the same time MidAmerican was operating a curtailment, a residential curtailment, they will jump to the conclusion that it had something to do with our program controlling their compressor and that somehow it damaged their compressor. We found through 16, 17 years of experience that is rarely the case, that more often than not, because of the extreme temperatures that are going on, that the air conditioner unit itself has been pressed to a limit and probably had experienced some sort of malfunction. But we end up from the heating and cooling contractor's perspective, it can create a little bit of misperception or confusion as to who was responsible for the unit failure.
So how long are these cycles on and off? I mean, it's one of the rare times during the year MidAmerican's doing it. I mean, how long are you shutting people off for that particular HVAC system?
It runs from – a typical event runs from 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. There's a little bit of leeway. We stagger the start and stop times on it, but it generally runs from 2 to 7, and the compressors are cycled on and off every 15 minutes.
Okay. So the compressors would still run half the time during those curtailment hours?
Yes.
Okay. The cost-benefit analysis on this is not very good, and I'm not sure I understand that. To me, I think there'd be tremendous value in not using that very expensive peak energy and not having to buy that on the market or turn on, you know, old and inefficient plants. Give me an idea about why the numbers don't look better on this.
To be honest, I think I'd have to go back into some of the computer runs to get a specific answer on that. I'm looking at one of my colleagues here to see if I think we'd have to go back and look at some of the computer runs.
Okay, and I mean, I doubt you can get that in the next 15 minutes, but then even afterwards, if you could follow up with some information, I'd just be curious for my own sake and why that is. For staff, you know, given the relatively poor ratios on this, why is staff supportive of the inclusion of this program?
Basically, this is something that we've approved before. A lot of other utilities are already doing this without having running through an energy efficiency rider. I guess I look at it as more of an externalized cost, so that's why I figured it didn't show up in the cost benefit because you're reducing peak power.
Well, and you did hit on one, and I just didn't know. I mean, I asked some advisors yesterday. I mean, I know I'm familiar with other load-serving entities that do this, and I wasn't sure whether or not they were all receiving cost recovery for it. I mean, if they aren't, if this makes sense for IOUs to do without cost recovery, why does it make sense for us to allow cost recovery?
I wouldn't say without cost recovery. I think most of them have had it allowed in rate cases rather than in riders.
Okay, thanks. The one I wasn't sure about, Mr. Rounds, was Xcel, just because her last rate case was so long ago. And I know they have a rather robust plan, and I just didn't know if they were getting recovery for that. But perhaps they are. They likely are, because I think they've also had that program for a long time.
Yeah, we're reviewing the application right now, and we've looked back, and I'm pretty sure there was money put towards that in their last rate case.
Okay, gotcha. Thanks very much. So if we move to the non-residential equipment, the C1, and on C16, I know there's a note that rebates are appropriate, are a little customized to the piece of equipment, but can somebody with MidAmerican give me a ballpark idea of how much we're talking? I mean, just give me a few examples.
Dave, could you run, or Dick, can you think of a couple of examples, the rebate on I didn't bring the copy of the Iowa or the Illinois brochure, so I'm gonna... We have somebody running to get some of the rebate information for...
Okay, then we'll move on. So on small commercial energy audit, C3, and specifically on C33, you notice that you're focused on small commercial buildings, those less than 25,000 square feet. Why that focus?
Well, on my one of my colleagues, Dick Walker, who is a product manager for that program, respond to that one.
This is Dick Walker. What we found was that the load on small businesses seems to correspond fairly closely with 25,000 square foot size. Customers are more likely to know the size of their building than they are to know how much energy they're using when they're calling for an audit request. And so when we looked at when we just identified all the loads and a body of buildings, 25,000 fell out. In other states where we do larger building audits, what we do is we use some discretion when buildings are near that 25,000. There could be a smaller than 25,000 square foot building with a lot of load that isn't affected by the shell and the mechanical equipment to heat cooling.
I mean, Dick, is it just the presumption that larger commercial customers will have the ability to take care of a lot of these things on their own and won't need these program offerings?
The largest customers are in a fairly good position, though there are many of them who do look for our help. But when we get to the customers that are what you might consider medium size, they pretty much need some assistance from the utility or someone to help them prioritize and identify opportunities to save energy.
Thanks. And the question I had asked earlier about incentive, you know, ballpark figures, Mr. Knadel and others with staff handed me some information. They had 2007 from Iowa, and just as an example, a number of fluorescent U-bend fixtures would be $10 a fixture. Some would be higher than that. Rather complicated formulas on something like an air conditioner, but you know, like $200 plus $100 times the SEER, the SEER rating minus 14, for the maximum rebate of $400. So that's sort of ballpark dollars.
Just I'm looking at what the rebates most likely would be for the remainder of 2009 on the gas side for furnace that meets the minimum 92% annual fuel utilization efficiency. The minimum rebate for a qualifying unit is $250 at that annual fuel utilization efficiency goes up. The maximum rebate would be $350.
Okay. I know I've belabored this a bit, so I'll ask just a couple of more, but they're sort of broader questions. I mean, this commission has used, you know, the performance bonus approach in the last couple of these filings. I mean, I just wonder, does staff have any concerns about whether or not that's sustainable? I mean, do we put the applicant in a position where they're maybe giving up what could be perceived as long time revenues year after year and giving that up for, you know, 1 year bonuses? I mean, any thoughts?
Could you repeat your question?
My concern is, and maybe I should start with Mid-American. I mean, Mid-American, is there any concerns on your part that you're giving up, you know, load that you would earn revenues on year after year after year? You're cannibalizing that, and in return you get a one-time payment?
This is Debbie Katsunis from Mid-American again. In our original filing, we did propose lost revenues on the gas side. I think that was a concern that as customers begin using more and more efficient equipment, that does erode the ongoing load for that particular customer. So that was a part of our original proposal. I think that we were not originally proposing the type of performance incentive that staff had suggested, although I think we do find that is performance incentive is definitely helpful for us, but we did have some concern over the ongoing lost revenues.
Well, and of course, this matters a lot less in an environment, unfortunately, we're probably entering where rate cases for most IOUs aren't going to be 15 years or 20 years between one another, but more often. So maybe it's not a big concern over the next, you know, during this next CapEx cycle. I don't know. Mr. Rounds, any other thoughts?
You know, I think the performance incentive mechanism that we suggested really kind of does the same thing, I guess, in our minds, but ideologically is a little bit easier for us. We just prefer that rather than, you know, allowing utility to recover margins over the lifetime of a new furnace or something like that.
Well, I'm fine with this mechanism for this filing. You know, what I haven't figured out as we move outside of the pilot project approach and as we, you know, look for something that's, you know, more transformational, I mean, I wonder, is there a difference? Should it be treated differently if you build a 100-megawatt natural gas, you know, intermittent resource? Should that be treated a lot differently than 100 megawatts that you may build into your system of efficiency? And isn't the efficiency, I mean, I don't know, are we providing the same incentives to build load through efficiency or build generation through efficiency as we are through just, you know, burning more fuels or turning more turbines with water? I don't know. for a pilot program, I think it's fine. I just sort of struggle with theoretically what's the best way to have the load serving entities comfortable with the idea that maybe their idea and our idea of what they do as a business has changed from serving, you know, to selling a product to providing a service. So more theoretical than probably directly applicable to this filing. Any other comments before I move on to the last question on that one? Okay. The whole proposal, the application was slimmed down. And again, Mr. Owens, I think you did a good job of explaining why you felt comfortable doing that. You know, the numbers make me a little nervous. And again, we're taking Mid-America's word, or at least I am, with the initial filing, because it wasn't, you know, staff didn't file anything that called into question that. But I mean, I think when you look at the societal cost benefit analysis, and I'm looking on A118 here, both under the revised filing and the original, were, you know, they're about the same amount of benefits, you know, 8.6 million or 8.7 million. But the costs under the original filing were lower. Instead of 5.8, they were 5.3. Ms. Rounds, can you say anything that makes me feel better about the fact that this revised filing has fewer net, has a lower estimated net benefit number and a lower cost benefit ratio number?
I guess my comment would be that, you know, I don't know that we trust the cost benefit of the programs that we had cut. You know, basically there's free ridership issues, this, you know, the same reason we didn't want to recover lost margins, things like that. We just don't trust the way that those programs are, the benefits of those programs are calculated.
So a question to Mid-American. I mean, I do think that for energy efficiency to work, you need to have a critical mass of offerings. You need to, there's some synergy, I think, that exists between offerings. They need to be consistent, hopefully, you know, across different borders. From Mid-American's perspective, does the proposal before us right now, does it have that critical mass be effective? Is there enough efficiency? Is this going to be as effective as we hope it's going to be, even slimmed down from the original proposal?
This is Rick Lighthizer with Mid-American, and I think the answer to your question is definitely yes. You know, I think when we had conversations with Mr. Rounds, Mr. Jacobson regarding the programs that were dropped, there was a lack of knowledge on our part as to the codes and standards that you have, for example, in the areas of new construction. And that explains some of the rationale for free ridership. But as I stated at the beginning, I think that the core programs here that we're most concerned about are the residential and the small commercial energy audits, the ability of customers to get additional audit services through the custom program on the non-res side, and the provision of the residential and the non-residential equipment programs, and again, the ability to get custom rebate through the custom program. These are the core programs that are going to have broad-based appeal, wide-based appeal amongst our South Dakota customers. We've seen some other companies across the country that have, for whatever reason, and I honestly haven't investigated them to fully understand why they have chosen to emphasize certain programs over others and not offer what we would consider to be a core set of programs. I think we do have the comprehensiveness, and that comprehensiveness is going to result in wide-based participation.
Rick, I want to say something here. This is Diane Munns, and I haven't waded in because Rick really is the expert on the filing and the programs that we have. But I just kind of want to put a caveat on this. Many of the programs, and much of our experience is based on what has been a good economy over the last years. I think we are in some uncharted waters on what impact is this economy going to have when you have people who are very nervous about whether their business is going to be there the next couple years, about watching their dollars, you know, that are they going to put the money out for the for any new equipment, be it efficient or non-efficient. So I think that it makes the audits very attractive to people. They want to know what they can do to save money, how it's going to impact the other programs. Then the other caveat is we've never had a stimulus like the one that is coming. There's money for efficiency, there's money for weatherization, there are pretty attractive tax credits for energy efficient equipment, and we don't have any idea how that's going to impact our programs. And these are things that we're just going to have to watch and see. We certainly will keep you informed, but there's a couple things going on now that we haven't ever seen before.
Okay, thanks, Ms. Munns. Any other questions, comments?
Commissioner, this is Greg Russell, but I just have one. And we could look at the last chart that Commissioner Johnson just referenced on A118. And although it doesn't fit perfectly, my question is this. We have a three-year window we're looking at with this study, and we're looking at the various five tests. To what extent do the numbers you show here capture the life cycle benefits of the energy efficiency measures that are being taken, or you estimate will be taken in the next 3 years? In other words, do these numbers reflect the total value of the benefit to the end user?
Yes, they do.
So
it takes into account the useful life of the various measures that we've assumed.
So if you upgrade efficiency on a particular piece of equipment, and that equipment is forecast to have a 20-year life, that entire benefit is included in your societal test, so to speak.
Correct.
Okay. That's it. Thank you.
Other questions or comments?
I just have one. On page E1-2, you say that Mid-American – the cost recovery factor will be separately stated on the customer bill, and the company's current billing system will be updated to add this functionality. Is that currently in the works?
Yes, that's correct, and it will be ready to go by May 1st.
Okay. And then could you explain how that is going to be clearly stated on your bill? Is it a separate line item? Is there going to be any definitions involved with it?
Yes, it will be a separate line item. It will be stated towards the bottom of the bill after, for example, on the electric side, they'll have their basic customer charge. They'll have their what I would call delivery charge, their fuel adjustment charge, and energy efficiency would be charged separately, and it would be after the fuel adjustment charge. The same way on the gas side, they'll have their basic service charge, their delivery charge, the purchase gas adjustment charge, and then separately stated will be the energy efficiency cost recovery charge. And hopefully the title will be somewhat self-explanatory. But in addition, we do have some education efforts. I think that the energy efficiency folks have to explain what that charge is on the bill. And we also have a customer letter that goes out, I believe it's quarterly, and we reference our energy efficiency programs in that customer letter very regularly.
Okay. How about savings? Is there any mention of how much they've saved being on this program?
Typically, this is Rick Lighthouser. We do not do that. Back years ago when we started in Iowa in 1991-1992, we attempted to do some of that. We used some generalized assumptions about savings, but what came back at us was customers saying, well, they didn't realize this exact amount of savings, and you get into some rather extensive discussions about differences in households, number of family members in households, different lifestyles, different sizes of homes, that kind of thing. And so to give a general savings number that may fit a very, very small percentage of the customers who participate, and it's not going to fit the rest of the customers who participate. And so you're going to spend a lot of time on the phone trying to explain that.
Okay. Thank you.
And just so that I'm clear on some of these benefit ratios, when you look at Table 9 on A118, and it shows the utility cost test, and the ratio there is 2.07. And the utility cost test is trying to be a measure of whether or not it will result. I mean, if it passes the test, it will lower average bills. And so am I right in looking at a $3 million investment into these programs, according to this ratio, it is estimated that it will reduce average bills $6 million over the lifetime of these improvements. Is that, am I understanding that right?
You're looking at the, I'll be the first to admit I'm not an expert on each of these particular tests, but I think the only way that you would see customer bills going down is if the ratepayer impact test was greater than 1.0 for all the programs.
Well, I think that's the non-participant test, though. I mean, if you look at AI-12, and if you look at the utility cost test that it mentions on line 5, programs that pass this test also lower average bills. Whereas the RIM test would be the non-participant test.
I'm sorry, which page were you on?
A-112.
Yep.
When it breaks down on the...
And you were reading, okay. Yes, you are correct.
All right, thanks very much. Any other questions or comments? Hearing none, any action? I would move that the commission approve the plan as filed with the suggestion made by staff that the filing be only annually rather than two separate filings. The discussion, motion has been made. Any discussion on the motion?
Other than to say thank you, this has been a long docket. I think it's obvious that Mid-American knows what they're talking about here, and as does staff. They've spent a considerable amount of time becoming experts on this, so thank you.
Well, and I would make, you know, one note of clarity. I mean, to focus on these cost-benefit ratios, the utility cost test, it's estimated 2.07. I mean, it is estimated that this plan will reduce average utility bills. I mean, that's what we want, to reduce average utility bills, and the filing before us, that's what it is estimated to do. By millions of dollars. Any other questions or any other discussion on the pending motion?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I would just add that it reduces tariffs as well, changes tariffs, and certainly from an efficiency standpoint, which is not only the goal of this commission, but a goal of commissioners across the United States and a goal of our the administration of Congress, this fulfills a lot of those efforts, and so I'm extremely pleased with the comprehensiveness of this filing.
That's a very good point. Other comments on the pending motion?
This is Karen Kramer from staff, and I'm your motion included an effective date of May 1, 2009, is that correct?
It did not, but it will now.
All right, thank
Thanks
you.
For the reminder. With that effective date, any other discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks very much to everyone. Any other business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we'll stand adjourned.